KaiserNetwork.org.
Okay. Well, hello, everyone. I think it's no secret that I'm Drew Altman. I suspect most of you, at least, know who I am. And let me welcome you to the Barbara Jordan Conference Center and this conversation on health with Aetna Chairman and CEO Jack Rowe and our Vice President Jackie Judd. And a special welcome to our KaiserNetwork.org viewers. You may not number in the millions yet, but there are a lot of you. You're growing all the time. You are intensely loyal, and we're very happy to have you. There are some regulars here, I see, but there are also some newcomers here as well. So for those of you who are newcomers, let me just tell you, we established the Conversations on Health series just as a bit of a break from the regular fare that we all relish in Washington, D.C., the sound bites and the food fights that we all live with, an opportunity to go a little bit deeper and look at some of the long-term trends and maybe be a little bit more reflective, and especially to spotlight people like Jack who play leadership roles on the issues that we work on and care about deeply at the foundation. Our first guest was actually Bono. Our first Conversations on Health, and now today, Jack Rowe. So we've actually traveled from Bono to Jack Rowe. It's been a bit of a while.
We actually both live in the same apartment house. In New York.
There you go.
Maybe you're just working your way down.
And he's meeting with the president, so he's become quite an establishment figure. I just want to say a few words about, Jack, and then I'll turn the proceedings entirely over to Jackie Judd. To understand how I view Jack, you first have to understand that I'm from Boston, which is a city and a medical community that has given us great institutions, such as the Boston Red Sox and the Beth Israel Hospital, and great leaders such as Jack Rowe and David Ortiz, who affectionately in Boston we call Big Poppy. And in fact, there is not one, but I think there are many Jack Rowes, and I want to tell you about three of them that I know of. Let me show you two, for starters. There is, first of all, let me call this Jack Rowe the official Jack Rowe, or this is Jack Rowe the Washington View. There you go. This is Jack Rowe, wait a minute, Chairman and CEO of Aetna. First of all, you note that it is Chairman and CEO. We don't get to do that in the foundation world. You can't be both. You have to have a chairman, or in my case, a chairwoman, Sheila Burke, who watches over you. But in Jack's world, you can be both chairman and CEO. And this is how Washington now thinks of Jack. And you all know about Aetna. You know, the millions served and the billions in revenues. And then just before this, I think Washington remembers that Jack was kind of the George Steinbrenner of healthcare in New York City. And before that, while there is a dim sense of this, I suspect, in Washington, a distinguished figure in healthcare in Boston, a professor, a clinician. Because there's a lot of snow and it's cold in Boston, you write things and a lot of publications, but the image, chairman and CEO of Aetna. Now there is a different view. This is the Boston view of Jack Rowe. Distinguished professor of medicine, founding director of the Division of Aging, Harvard Medical School, and chief of gerontology at Beth Israel Hospital. A leader in his field, many fields, a pioneer, a distinguished scholar. Can you imagine this? Author of 200 scientific publications, translating knowledge into words that average people can understand through a very successful book. And then he drifted to New York, which is not something that people in Boston understand terribly well. I'll say more about this in a minute. Boston sort of lost track of Jack after that. Two very different views of Jack Rowe. Two different Jack Rowes. They're both here today with us for this Conversations on Health. Then there is a third Jack Rowe, which I especially want to talk about today. And that is the Jack Rowe my family and I have known for now, I guess, a great many years. This is the Jack Rowe who worked with my dad when Jack was an intern and resident at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston, and my dad was an internist in the community and on the staff. I think my dad filled every empty bed in the Beth Israel Hospital. And in fact, you can directly track the BI's financial problems to the day my dad retired. And now, in fact, the BI's finances have improved. This is the Jack Rowe who started his career as a nephrologist and who once actually said, and I wonder what the context was for this, I think it was in Business Week, but there was this quote I couldn't understand. He said, "The physiology of the kidney is beautiful to me." I thought that was a strange quote. But then I looked around, and we did some checking, and we found this on this website called, I think it's called medicalillustrations.com, and you know what? It is beautiful. At least looked at through the eyes of this particular artist named Kaplan. And it turns out that, and Jack would know a lot more about this than I would, the Egyptians were quite enamored of the kidney. I guess it's because when they killed you, they had a lot of time to study the vital organs. I don't know why it was. And a major part of the kidneys is something called, what do they call it? The medullary pyramids? Is that? Jack is going to talk about the medullary pyramids for the next hour.
Uh-oh.
I think, yeah. So they are quite beautiful, and now I understand the quote. This is also this third Jack Rowe, is the Jack Rowe who was always ahead of the curve, who despite his affection for the kidney, and it's actually not unrelated, quickly became Harvard and then one of the world's leading gerontologists. As my dad put it when I asked him last week, he was so out front, he was a gerontologist before there really were old people. Then all of a sudden, Jack was plucked from gerontology in the BI to head one of the largest hospitals in New York, and then ultimately one of the largest, if not the largest, hospital mega mergers in the history of our country at Mount Sinai and NYU, which from a Boston medical perspective is sort of like going from the Red Sox to the Yankees. You don't actually do that, but he did. So I asked my dad, well, how did that happen? And he said, who knows how they picked these guys? But it was a huge loss for us, he quickly added. This was also the Jack Rowe who in 1989, when I was briefly the nominee to run HICFA, a fate which, thanks to John Sununu, I escaped, sent the most wonderful letter to my dad telling him that it was now okay that I did not become a physician because I was contributing in other ways. And my dad kept this letter in a scrapbook, and it was revealing of the Boston perspective that at the end of the letter, the long letter, he simply said, "Letter from John Rowe, MD, formerly a resident nephrologist and geriatrician at Beth Israel Hospital." That's how he thought of Jack Rowe. There's no Aetna, there's no Mount Sinai. Only two letters came when I was the HICFA nominee, the one from Jack to my dad, and just after I withdrew my nomination, a letter from a certain then governor of Arkansas, who we all later got to know very well. So I don't know what image you have in your mind when you think of the CEO of Aetna, no, excuse me, the chairman and CEO of Aetna, when you are at the counter at Walgreens or at CVS, or at Long's, but for me, Jack Rowe is a very special guest and a very special leader in American healthcare, and it really is a deep personal pleasure to have all the different Jack Rowes here with us today. And with that, I'll turn our program over to Jackie Judd to get us started. Good to see you all. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Drew. And let me add my thanks, Dr. Rowe. Not often we get to show a slide of a psychedelic kidney.
I know. Well, I'm going to try to recover from this introduction here.
Let's switch subjects for a moment.
I'll be all right, yeah.
As Drew mentioned, you spent many, many years as a gerontologist, and I'm wondering how well you think our healthcare system is preparing for the onslaught of all of us aging baby boomers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think... In some ways, we've prepared very well with Medicare. I mean, I think Medicare is a huge success. It's a tremendous program. I think it's generally very well received. It's not particularly by those who understand it. I think that we have a little bit more time than most people think, and we're being advantaged by changes in healthcare and in people's lifestyles. And let me tell you what I mean. I think there's a lot of talk about the age wave and how we're being swamped by previously unimagined numbers of old people. But the facts are, of course, that during the a period of depression or recession or any economic downturn, the birth rate falls, fecundity decreases. And that happened starting around 1929 for about 10 years in this country. So that 70 years or 65 to 70 years after that, the number of people entering the cohort over 65 declines. And so instead of getting a rapid increase in the number of older people, it's really relatively flat. We have John Rother from AARP here, and he'll sort of correct me afterwards if I make some mistakes here. But I think that we're not seeing a dramatic increase, and we won't for a while, until 2010 or 2015 or so, and then the increase will be in people who are 65. And people who are 65 now are different than people who are 65 30 years ago.
What did they say now? Today's 40 is yesterday's 50?
The most graphic example for me is a painting by a Whistler, Study in Black and Gray, number 12, I think, which is also called Whistler's Mother. And it's a painting of a frail elderly woman in a white lace cap and a black dress, sitting in a chair, kind of forlornly looking out into the distance. And if you go through an audience like this and you say, how old is this woman? You get 87, 89, 92, you know. My mother's 95. She looks younger than that woman. Whistler's mother was 67 when that painting was painted. And that's what a 67-year-old looked like then. And now 67s look different. So I think we are being helped in our preparation for the burden of disease associated with advancing age by the secular changes in lifestyle. We're also being helped by the changes in the healthcare system that recognize that old people deserve treatment. It used to be you didn't get operated on for heart disease if you were an old person, or you never got dialyzed, or if you got cancer chemotherapy, you got half the dose because they were afraid you were old and frail, so you didn't get the beneficial effect. And I think we know a lot more about that. On the other side of the coin, not to go on too long here, but the problem we have is really not with the number of old people, but the number of old people. Because we do have previously unimagined numbers of frail, multiply impaired old people over age 80 or 85 with a 40 or 50% prevalence of cognitive impairment. And those individuals are a group that our current healthcare system and its, particularly its financing and its workforce, are completely unprepared to deal with. Neither the doctors nor the nurses are trained effectively to deal with those people. And the workforce in long-term care is not adequate to deal with these numbers. And society has not dealt with many of the ethical issues that we have to face to deal with the collision of the science and technology with this population. So my concern is really on the long-term care side and the frail elderly side. But otherwise, I'm pretty optimistic. And as Drew mentioned, and his father was a distinguished physician at Beth Israel, and I learned a lot from him. Back in 1970, when I was an intern, no one had even considered this. Mm-hmm. And now it's a very important major piece of our health policy. So I think we're making progress.
Are there enough doctors being trained?
Yeah, I think the geriatricians will tell you there aren't enough geriatricians. But my view is that a geriatrician is really a specialist who can see in consultation difficult cases and can do research, develop new knowledge, Jackie, inform policy issues, and educate physicians in the principles of geriatric medicine. But the geriatricians are really the family practitioners and the internists who need to be able to deal with the medical problems of an older population. Also, people need to redefine aging. I mean, when I was practicing medicine, which for those of you who know me, pretty scary thought, but we didn't see patients under 75. My average age of my patients was 87. A 65-year-old woman was in my office. She was talking with me about her mother. So we shouldn't get too hung up with the idea of all these 65-year-olds. I mean, we don't need geriatricians for 65-year-olds.
Good to know. Just one last question on this idea of preparation. There was a survey that came out this morning. Aetna was a part of it, And one of the striking findings was that people in the 45 to 60 age range have given so little thought to the finances of their health care
right.
for when they reach old age. Does that concern you?
Yeah. We're very concerned about this. We have initiated a program to try to assist people in planning for their health care futures. There has been an emphasis on planning for your financial future with respect to handling your usual and customary living expenses. And people have pensions and they have 401ks and they have investment advisors with respect to this general issue. And what's been missing, of course, is a recognition that parallel to that, not orthogonal to it, but parallel to it, is an increasingly important need to plan for how you're going to handle your health care expenditures, because Medicare doesn't cover everything, and it certainly doesn't cover long-term care in the main, although we have trouble getting America to understand that. And we see certain of the products that we may touch on in this conversation, such as the so-called consumer-driven products, as part of an emerging set of solutions or opportunities for people with choices that may help them begin to plan. But it really is irresponsible not to plan for handling your health care expenditures. Pari passu with planning for your living expenditures.
Particularly when a piece of the expectations is that a longtime employer will continue to give you the health benefits they may have promised, and as many workers for GM realized this week, that won't always be the case.
Well, that may will not be the case, and the workers from GM are late to the game.
Yeah.
There are, I think, the proportion of companies that offer health benefits for retirees is half of what it was just 15 or 20 years ago, and is now a relative minority of companies. And as newly employed individuals work their way through the workforce, who are now currently under 40 years old or so, the likelihood that they're going to have significant health benefits when they retire is very low unless something substantial changes. So I think that's part of it. The other part of it is the recognition that, in general, people retire well before they're Medicare beneficiary.
Mm-hmm.
People tend not to realize that gap until they're facing it 2 years from now, and then it's
when it's too late.
Yeah.
Right. Well, let's talk about health care costs for a moment. The rate of increase has declined in the past several years. Do you see that as something permanent or a temporary dip?
I guess the answer is always that it's not permanent, because that's the answer to everything, I guess. I think the rate of rise, the year-over-year increase, is less. It's decelerating. It's important to emphasize, of course, that everyone in this audience would understand it doesn't mean healthcare costs are going down. They're just not rising quite as fast. They still continue to rise at three times or so the general inflation rate. And there's an argument as to whether or not that's a bad thing. Everybody in the world except David Cutler is over here thinking it's a bad thing. David Cutler's over here. So we can talk a little bit about that. But I think there has been a gradual deceleration in health care costs, in the first derivative of health care costs. I believe it is seen throughout the marketplace, both in the commercial insured marketplace and in some of the government-sponsored programs. I believe that most observers in the marketplace predict that it will remain in this mode for the next 18 months or so. It seems as if each year there is a different element which is contributing to this deflation, though, Jackie. It's interesting that it's... 5 or 6 years ago, if you looked at the major elements of healthcare costs, and we unpack this into 16 different categories and look at it every month for every product in every market in a very rigorous way, because we believe in some fundamental view that observation itself is therapeutic if you pay enough attention to the data early on. But if you look at it, there are physician payments and outpatient payments and inpatient payments and pharmaceuticals and specialty pharmaceuticals and imaging and others. And what's really striking right now is that all of those different elements are running at about the same rate. They are all running at inflation rates, which is between 5% for physician payments to, and inflation is, I'm using to represent both cost and volume. I know the economists in the audience will say inflation is just unit cost, but I'm using it as a mixture of cost and volume. To the highest, which is maybe pharmaceuticals, is maybe 9%. So they're all entrained in a narrow range, whereas 5 or 6 years ago, you would see things spiking. And for the foreseeable future, the thing that makes us think that things will not spike up unless there's some pandemic or something like that, relates to the fact that a very substantial number of medications are going to become generic over the next year and a half.
Right, go off patent.
And pharmaceutical costs year over year are not only the highest of those 5 or 6 major categories that I mentioned, but they represent, you know, 14 to 16% of the total healthcare dollar. So if you get a 3 or 4% reduction in pharmaceutical inflation, that's worth 0.5% in the overall market for healthcare, which is a huge number. So so that's going to be a break on healthcare inflation, I think, over the next year, year and a half.
And if you could wave a magic wand and actually bring down actual costs, what is the one thing you would do?
If I did that and I knew I could do that, I'd probably buy health insurance stocks. but in order to do it, I think that it's very difficult question. The issue, if I could really do it in one simple thing, I would eliminate the system whereby there are different mandates regarding different benefits in 50 different states. You probably expected me to say something about disease management or something about shortening the patent life of brand name drugs, or, you know, sell more consumer driven products because they have a lower trend. But one of this very important issues is that we have two forms of health insurance in the United States. For large companies who are self-insured, they operate under the rules of engagement of ERISA, and they are not subjected to individual state mandates for various kinds of services. And accordingly, they can sell products which have less extensive benefits, but they also have lower costs, and that helps them control their healthcare costs to some degree. The fully insured customers, who are the individuals and the small businesses and the middle market businesses that don't have the balance sheet to be self-insured, I mean, General Motors doesn't need, well, maybe General Motors is a bad choice, but let's say General Electric doesn't need to rent Aetna's balance sheet to cover the healthcare costs of their beneficiaries, which is what a fully insured customer does. They can use their own balance sheet and be self-insured. But so those small companies that are fighting hardest to try to be able to retain healthcare benefits for their beneficiaries are subjected to varying mandates in varying states, and we believe that they increase healthcare costs and we believe they provide a heterogeneous playing field across different states. And so if there were one regulatory thing I could do, if we didn't have that situation, I think that would be helpful in controlling costs.
And minus
here,
minus,
we're in Washington, so I'll give you a regulatory answer.
But minus the magic wand, I know that something Aetna very much believes in that you mentioned earlier was the consumer-driven health care plans.
Right.
Why?
Well, we think give you a little background. We'll step back a little bit, if I can, Jackie, because we have a little time here. And I don't want to go all the way back to sort of first the earth cool, but, you know, we did have a very significant number of initiatives in healthcare and in health insurance that were on the supply side. And by the supply side, I mean physicians and hospitals and other providers. And those initiatives were various kinds of restricted networks, and those were prior approvals and prior authorizations and capitation and other approaches to try to reduce utilization. And those were effective in reducing utilization, but met with a backlash from customers and the media and elected officials and, most importantly, I think, in my mind, screenwriters. And so many companies were kind of driven off the field and into their foxhole, and they basically say, okay, we're going to price our products in an actuary sound way. We're going to pay the claims. We're going to keep our head down and get out of the way. We're not going to get accused of trying to interfere with the practice of medicine. What has emerged now is a new approach which has both a supply side and a demand side initiative. And the demand side initiative is what I would call the consumer directed products. Mm-hmm. And the idea there is to get people out of the position where they didn't have any transparency as to what the actual costs of care were, and where the payments they were making were not just through their payroll deduction for their share of the premium, but were actually at the point of care. And to give some people some, quote, skin in the game, the experience that we have had with these products, and our company is more experienced, I think, than any other company nationally with this in terms of scope and duration, has been that they do significantly reduce the year-over-year increase in healthcare costs, very significantly, and that reduction is persistent in the second year. There is, on the other hand, concern among some people that the findings of the health insurance experiment, the RAND experiment, Newhouse and et al., that increasing cost sharing leads some people, particularly those who are most ill and poor, to forego certain treatments. And that widespread utilization of these products would result in individuals not having preventive services and not taking medications for hypertension, diabetes, et cetera. What we have done in order to reduce the likelihood of that is we have taken medications, antihypertensives, anti-diabetic agents, lipid-lowering agents, osteoporosis agents, asthma agents, prenatal vitamins, maternal and childhood vitamins, out of the deductible. So there are no copayments and no deductibles. And we've also done that with all preventive services that are recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. What we see in our products is that preventive services are actually increased in their use, and we don't see a significant reduction in the use of the medication classes that I mentioned. And that's been our approach to modify our products to try to mitigate this potential adverse effect, I think. And so we've been pleased with it. I think that on the other hand, there are varying products out in the marketplace. They're not all structured the same. People have to be careful. These products are not necessarily for chronically ill people who are going to have lots of health care expenditures.
And would you say that even when it comes to the model that Aetna's adopted?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think if you know you're going to be ill and hospitalized a couple of times, you're going to be through your out-of-pocket deductible mm-hmm. by St. Patrick's Day, you know. And that may not be the right product for you. I would also say I think that these products are kind of in, this is release 1.0, Jackie, of these products, that we can modify these products over time. We can connect these products with disease management initiatives targeting individuals with chronic disease. I think that over time, they will be functional for the whole population. But at the current time, we do see some selection of healthier people into them. What is it? Another thing that's interesting about them is it was thought that this would be for people who were well off, and it turns out that very substantial numbers of people with incomes under $40,000 a year are signing up for these products on an individual basis.
If you don't mind, I want to dramatically switch gears here now and ask you a couple of quick questions before we open it up to the audience. One is, I know that at some point Aetna adopted some voluntary reporting guidelines to get at the issue of disparities in health and health care. Have you concluded anything yet from the information you've collected?
Well, we've concluded several things. First of all, in contrast to many of the predictions, I still have my job. I was told unequivocally that this was the third rail of healthcare politics, asking people to tell us what their race was not going to be well received, and it was going to be perceived as being racist. My view was that there were abundant data that people in certain racial and ethnic groups were at increased risk for a whole variety of things that's well known to this audience. And unless somebody told me what their race was, I wouldn't know whether they were at risk, and neglecting to collect that information was racist. So that was my view. I think you can do geocoding, and you by looking at some zip codes and by looking at some last names, you can get a pretty good chance that somebody living in a certain area of Los Angeles named Wong might be Chinese. But the fact is that for African Americans who are at very substantial risk for many of these disparities, it doesn't work nearly as well. And so what have we learned? We learned that many of our customers loved it.
You got a good rate of participation?
I had the chairman and CEO of a major American hotel chain come up to me and thank me and tell me that he had many, many Hispanic employees, particularly in Florida and Texas and California, who were working in his hotels, and that he had no idea that they weren't getting access to the care that he thought they were getting. This was terrific, and thank you. And what we've seen is that the government, ARC, with help from RAND, Nikki Lurie, particularly experienced in this area, and others have brought together health plans, and I think there are general activities now to get most health plans to do this. We've had millions of our members voluntarily give us this information. Now, quickly to get to what have we learned that's, other than that we're still standing, what have we learned? And I think we've learned, we've sensitized a lot of employers to this issue, and we have analyzed our patient population with certain chronic diseases, including diabetes, and we have found significant disparities within the population according to racial and ethnic backgrounds with respect to their adherence to certain ADA guidelines, for instance, even within case management programs. So what that means, and it shouldn't be surprising, is that we need to modify case management programs to have a cultural competency. The other thing we did in the context of this whole initiative was I said to myself, look, we have 1,500 clinicians at Aetna, physicians and nurses, and if we're going to do something about racial and ethnic disparities, let's see if we can have a workforce that can manage this issue. So I mandated, it's so much fun to be the chairman and CEO of a for-profit company. I mean, try to mandate something at Mount Sinai, you know, you can imagine what would happen. but I've mandated
good to be boss.
that these individuals all take a course in cultural competency. And so all these nurses and case managers and condition managers and physicians took this course, pre and post tests, et cetera. The results were excellent, and we really feel that we're developing cultural competency within the company, and I hope that happens in all the other companies.
Have any other insurance companies looked at what you're doing and said, well, this is something we should be doing too?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of learning going on across. I don't want to position our company as being the only company interested in this by any means. And I think that, you know, we're watching what others are doing. Others are watching what we're doing. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that I was not electrocuted did encourage a lot of the others. And I think what you'll see is more companies trying it in different ways. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you now to join the audience. We bring a stool up right to the front of the riser, and you could take some of their questions.
Sure.
And while you're getting settled, I'll ask you.
John, would you want to correct anything I've said while you're here?
Oh, he's going to have a chance. Don't you worry. One question I wanted to ask you also was about Katrina. I know that after Katrina, Aetna relaxed some of the requirements for its clients. Is that still going on?
Yeah, I think health plans in general were able to do a number of things. And I want to give a lot of credit to Karen Ignani and her staff at AHIP. It seemed there were round-the-clock conference calls of all the CEOs of the health plans to figure out what we can do jointly. But one of the things that we did, in addition to relaxing requirements for you can go to a physician who's out in network and you can get a prescription filled even if it's not the time to get it filled because, of course, the other one washed away, is we were able, all the health plans were able, or many of them, were able to make their databases available. So if you're a physician in the Astrodome and some patient comes up to you and says, you know, I don't have any of my medicines, but here's my Aetna card, you will be able to reconstitute their medical record and find out what prescriptions they actually had. And I think that was very helpful. And we're continuing that, obviously, because people are still displaced, very significantly displaced.
Okay, let's start taking questions from the audience. Who wants to go first? Yes, right up here. Wait, sir, can you identify yourself and your affiliation?
I'm Bernie. Can you hear me? Anna?
Yep.
Federally from the Topkins County Healthcare KS.
We're going to give you another one. This morning.
And the one thing you would do to bring down the health care costs would simply be to go to a national health care plan, a single payer plan, which would eliminate those costs. The best thing we could do is probably get Aetna out of the health care field. How do you take on that?
Is there a question there?
That's I think we disagree.
In what way?
I think Aetna is part of the solution, not part of the problem. And I think there are lots of ways that private health insurers can improve the quality and access to care and help control the costs. I don't think it's proven that having a national system would help correct the healthcare cost problems. The costs, most economists agree, are driven up not by health insurers, whose operating margins are, as you probably know, well less than 10% on average, but by demographic changes and technological advances, neither of which are under our control. So those are a couple of the ways we disagree, but I'm sure there are others.
We have an online question. We asked people out there to email questions ahead of time, and one is from a reporter. In August, Aetna launched a web initiative that offers consumers access to service pricing that the insurer has negotiated with 5,000 doctors in the greater Cincinnati area. Will this program be extended beyond Cincinnati, and if so, when?
Well, let me comment on that. We've gotten a lot of attention. I think that must have come out on a slow news day. We certainly got a lot of attention on that, although the communications staff worked very hard. It's an effort to give more transparency to individuals if they have more financial responsibility in a fund that they're paying out of, that they should know what the various doctors are charging for the same kinds of services. We obviously piloted this in one area in which we had worked closely with doctors, and the response we've gotten, particularly from our customers all around the country who want to know why we can't do it in their area, certainly has led us to develop plans to have this in a number of markets as soon as we can. But there's a fair amount of groundwork that has to be done to work with physicians in the area to make sure that this transparency is something that they understand, what you're doing and why. Yeah.
What is the timeline for putting more markets?
Well, certainly we're not going to have any other markets on that program in this calendar year. Mm-hmm. And I think that others would come on next calendar year, we would hope.
Yeah. Okay. Another question from the audience. John?
Pleasure to see you, John.
Pleasure to see you, Jack. Thank you for being here. I would have answered the question about the single thing to reduce healthcare costs in terms of putting the entire system on a 21st century information platform.
Right.
And I wonder if you could talk about maybe why that hasn't happened yet, what some of the barriers are, and also what you might see as the potential if we ever do get to a truly information.
Well, I think that's a fair point. I think there are probably 10 right answers to the question of what would be the single thing you would do. And but the difference between mine and yours is that yours costs money and mine doesn't. And so you want to make a big investment in order to save costs and improve quality over time, and I certainly concur. I do think, by the way, with New Orleans, I hope the people who rebuild the healthcare system in New Orleans take this opportunity and have the resources to build the 21st century healthcare system in New Orleans. I mean, the only hospital in New Orleans that was able to have portable personal health records for the diaspora of individuals who left New Orleans was the VA. Other hospitals are just not capable of doing it, to my knowledge. And so here's an opportunity to really build it in. And we all hope Dr. Braler gets sufficient support for what he wants to do. We would agree. I think that quality and cost can be improved if we make significant advances toward an electronic health record. As far as why hasn't it happened, you know, there's an interesting article in Health Affairs last month about why it hasn't happened. All kinds of interesting conjecture. I think that everyone thinks that everyone else is going to pay for it. And I think, based on my experience running a very large academic health science center, no one ever understood why we didn't do it at Mount Sinai. But I had no access to capital in order to do it. I do now at Aetna. Right. I just don't have a hospital anymore. We think, from our point of view, excellent databases with respect to our patients. The other problem, John, which is, I think it's an important aspect of the problem, physicians come to us and they say, why don't you give us the money to upgrade the IT in our office? But maybe only 10% of their patients are Aetna members. But they're not going to upgrade the IT for 10% of their patients. They're going to do it for their entire population. So then we're subsidizing all the other companies, or CMS. And there hasn't been a coordinated effort to get all the payers together so that you get out of this unequal playing field. I think that's been an important stumbling block.
Is there a question over here in the back?
Good afternoon. My name is Mara Udelman, and I'm with the National Health Law Program. And I want to go back to the issue of health disparities. And we really do commend the work that you've undertaken in data collection and the cultural competency. In particular, I want to ask you specifically about language barriers and what Aetna is particularly doing to address health disparities caused by language barriers for their limited English proficient clients or patients there, particularly whether Aetna provides and or pays for interpreters and translations of materials in the doctor's offices, what steps you've undertaken, what steps you may be undertaking, and how also we can engage other private insurers in meeting this need.
Well, I think that there is a general recognition in the health insurance industry that that you have to do everything in English and Spanish, and we obviously have large numbers of individuals working in our service centers and claim centers that are bilingual. Beyond that, what we generally do is we subscribe with a service that makes interpreters for all known languages that are relevant to our patient population, which is very large, 15 million nearly. And so we just call this service, a very well-known company. We get them on the phone, and they provide somebody who will speak Serbo-Croatian or Urdu or whatever language is particularly relevant to that patient, whether the patient's in the physician's office or is calling about a claim or whatever. That's a service that we offer. Yeah. And I think that the issue is whether or not one needs to go beyond that, whether one can measure a need or a benefit to having actually full-time people in the employ of the company speaking those various languages. And my experience in running hospitals, very large hospitals in New York, which is still, of course, a big melting pot, was that it was easier to have a kind of ad hoc consultant type person you could call than rely on the fact that so-and-so in food service would be in working that day when there was somebody in the emergency room who spoke that dialect, that you knew you could call that person and get the help. And there are issues of confidentiality also that come up all the time. And so we think using the outsource service works for us.
We have a question from a doctor in California on an issue you touched on earlier briefly. 5 to 10% of the public account for 50 to 90% of the health care cost.
Right.
And it is at the end of life that accounts for the vast majority of one's lifetime health expenses. What do you suggest to address health care costs, focusing on these two aspects of increasing health care costs?
Okay, Jackie. Well, those are two very good questions. I think let's deal with end of life first. I got in real trouble in the Senate Finance Committee years ago in this issue because I was testifying and some senator said to me, you know, this is really ridiculous, all these costs at the end of life, we have to do something about this. And I said, Senator, reminds me of the story about somebody who did an analysis of fatalities and train wrecks, and they discovered that most of the fatalities were in the last car in a train, so their solution was to get rid of the last car in a train. I said, I don't really think we can make those expenses go away. And which year of life, Senator, did you expect the expenses to be greatest in? The mid-year of life, the first year of life? I mean, you know, people get sick and they die. I think the issue is also important to recognize that in my understanding and my days in MedPAC are over, and many people in MedPAC are happy about that, but my understanding when I was in MedPAC for those years was that the proportion of Medicare expenses that is attributable to end of life has not changed in 20 years. So it's very stable. The issue is not spending less in the last year of life, it's spending it better, giving people more choice, giving people the opportunity to participate in hospice and at the same time have access to effective therapies if they become available. And I'm very proud of the fact that Aetna, I think, was the first major health insurer last year to come out with a specific program in care at the end of life. And what we give our members choice, and that program is working very, very well, and large numbers of members are opting to go into hospice rather than stay in the hospital. And at the same time have continued access to effective treatments as they become available. So, but I do believe, and I believe it's generally considered to be a cost-neutral activity. I think Medicare studies suggested if you're dying of cancer, the cost may be a little higher with hospice, and if you're dying of non-cancer-related things like heart disease and lung disease, the costs are a little less. But in general, it's pretty even. So I think it's about changing the way we spend the money, not trying to save money at the end of life. With respect to 5% of people who are responsible for 50% of the expenses, I think there are two things that are worth emphasizing. One is that 5% of people is not the same 5% of people every year. About half of those people, in fact, were in a high expenditure group because they had a baby.
Or they had a good thing?
Which is almost always a good thing. Or they had an accident. Or they had, they had a heart attack, maybe, but they didn't have one the year before, and they're not going to have one the year after. And so they come in and out of this high cost. But people think of it as 5% of the population walking around chronically ill in and out of hospitals. That's not what it is. But so there's about 2.5% of the population. It might be responsible for 25% of the healthcare costs or whatever that are chronically persistently ill, and that is an area where disease management, pharmacy management, condition management, care management play tremendous roles. We believe the ROI, if you will, there in quality of care, quality of life, patient satisfaction, and financial return is significant in that population, and we emphasize those programs targeted to that population. And I would like to emphasize particularly that in mental and behavioral illness, there's a tremendous opportunity to improve outcomes, get people back to work, with targeted depression disease management programs or even programs to detect depression that currently isn't being detected. So we think that what health plans can do to help with this hyper-concentration of costs is, in fact, to target those individuals with special programs. And I think that's a big distinction in the industry now from where it was 10 years ago.
Okay. Anybody in the audience over on this side? Lady next to John.
Hi, I'm Diane Livesey from the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. And I was just wondering your thoughts about the new Medicare prescription drug benefit and how it's going to work and help people.
Sure. Thank you. I think the Medicare prescription drug benefit is got a couple surprises in it. The first is that there has been a lower premium than people expected. And for beneficiaries, that's a good thing. Secondly, there are many more organizations that have bid than expected, and that's having two effects. One is the number of choices that people will have will be greater. And the second is that the companies participating will have fewer beneficiaries, likely, than they had expected. With respect to the first effect, there will be more opportunity for choice. While that's generally good, my hope is that it's not so confusing for people that, you know, they're getting mail and phone calls from 10 different or 7 different entities that it's very difficult for them to work their way through that. And there may be some shakeout over time in the marketplace so that some of those would drop out. With respect to the fact that companies will have fewer members, I think that may participate in the shakeout because if certain companies had certain models where they were depending on X number of the auto enrollees, the dual eligible Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries, and they didn't get that number, they may wind up not participating in the next year. So we'll just have to see. I think, we're enthusiastic about the program. We've invested a significant amount of resources for infrastructure. We have an agreement with CVS and Rite Aid to help market it. And plus, we have over 9 million national account customers and large national companies who have retirees who may have been on the Medicare prescription drug benefit, and we hope to enroll them through their companies in our program. So we intend to participate in it. Just as a gerontologist, I think it's a good thing. I mean, I'm not trying to take a political stand here one way or the other. I understand the parties are closely are strongly divided with respect to their support for this, but I think that it is just absurd to have healthcare benefits that don't include pharmaceuticals. And it just there's no face validity to it at all. And so I think it's a good thing.
Final question from the audience. Yes, over here on this side.
Laura Truman with the Coalition for Affordable Health Coverage. When you look at new business opportunities for Aetna, you're going to be involved with the Medicare. I know that you all have targeted different pockets of the uninsured to try to get them health care policies. One of the other pockets of about 53 million people is Medicaid, and some states are trying some initiatives where they are producing vouchers, like HSA vouchers, figuring out what would a 50-year-old diabetic person cost in Medicaid, giving them the equivalent and saying regular Medicaid or shop around.
Sure.
Is that something that Aetna would be interested in or you see as a viable solution public policy-wise or for private companies?
Well, Laura, the subsets you referred to, just for people's interest and information, if they're not familiar, we purchased a company that offers student coverage for college and university students. There are 4 million uninsured college and university students in America, almost 10% of the total uninsured population. And we think that that's outrageous, and it's a very important population to cover, and the coverage is quite affordable. We also purchased a company that offers healthcare benefits for hourly and part-time workers, so that if you work at the Gap or a Costco or a Staples or a Home Depot, and you don't work enough hours to get the usual full benefit, there is a policy available to you to purchase through the employer that, and we think, you know, that's several million additional uninsured Americans. So if you take the uninsured population and you fractionate it, centrifuge it, you can pick out populations who can be covered in the private sector in different ways. And we're proud of our initiatives there and continuing to look for additional populations. With respect to the Medicaid population, Aetna has not played a major role in Medicaid. We have participated in New Jersey in the past, but we sold that to AmeriChoice years ago. We do have a contract in Texas and some other areas. We have about 100,000 Medicaid beneficiaries covered in some way in our membership of 15 million, almost 15 million people. But what we see, and just to end my comments here, we see that the commercially insured population is very gradually shrinking, about 1% a year. Not fast, but very gradually. We have success growing our business organically in the competition, so we're doing fine. But the government-sponsored programs are growing. Medicare is growing, Medicaid is growing, DIRGO in Maine, other programs in maybe Wisconsin, Oregon, Iowa, wherever, you know. And we're increasingly interested in programs like that, state programs, state retirement systems, state employee systems, school systems, et cetera. And we have created an entire portion of our administration which is focusing on those potential customers that we didn't have before. So we're giving more attention to that opportunity as well as its sister and brother opportunities than Aetna would have 2 or 3 years ago.
I have one final question. Drew started this event by mentioning how many different hats you've worn through your career, and I'm wondering if there is one other hat at some point in the future that you also would like to wear.
Well, I'd like to own the Yankees. I have very firm ideas about what I would do, and I'm glad Torrey, I'm glad Torrey has signed up for another year or two.
Keep A-Rod?
I would keep A-Rod. I mean, he didn't do well during the playoffs, but plus I think it would be very costly not to keep him. I don't know. You know, I'm happy in my job at this point, and I don't know what I will do next, although I certainly will hope to do something else next. And, you know, only in America does a guy get a chance to do as many kind of seemingly different things as I have had. Luckily, the chance to do. But I will say that there has been a very significant advantage to me to having been a physician, an educator, researcher, administrator, and now on the business side. And I think I have a different perspective on healthcare than I had before, so I hope to find a way to contribute. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I want to thank the audience here on the web, but most of all you, Dr. Rowe, for your candor and your graciousness.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Drew.